Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. My guest tonight is Dr. Andreas Westerle, who you will remember gave us so much good information last October and November. In fact, five times he's appeared with me. Andreas was born in Prague and lived through the end of war and the post-war anti-German terror there. He has a PhD in several fields, has taught in prestigious universities in the U.S. and Europe. He now lives in Wisconsin, where he has just lived through another terror, sort of, a fierce winter with tons of snow. But he is tough, and along with being highly knowledgeable, and we're fortunate to have him here. Before we begin, I want to put tonight's topic in some relationship to last week's discussion of Jewish rule, because I'm going somewhere with this. This topic, and I'm not going to be dropping it anytime soon. I believe we need to understand what Jewish rule means for us and will mean for us as it continues in the future, or if it continues in the future. As it stands, we have examples from the past to study. Bruce Campbell made that point last week. The Russians under the Bolshevik Revolution led by internationalist Jews is one. We have the post-World War II Soviet bloc of Eastern European nations to study. We have the Germans after the unconditional surrender in 1945. There we see new concentration camps for Germans, the theft of all their industry, technology, and cultural wealth, the intentional starvation and deprivation of the populace, the rigorous re-education program, the destruction of their national identity. We have the same in Palestine today under the rule of Jewish control. We see the same thing happening in slower motion in the United States today. This should alarm all of us who are not Jews, but the worldwide Jewish control of media does its best to blunt awareness of the Jewish source of these unpleasant changes. Therefore, my purpose is to reveal in all its ugliness and immeasurable suffering what is in store for Gentiles in the so-called free world. Our focus tonight will be on how Jews carried out this program against Germans via the Morgenthau Plan and the Nuremberg War Criminal Tribunals. Now, this idea that the Jews were behind this is my idea, and I'm not putting this onto Dr. Westerle, but I'm going to be wanting to find out from him just how much truth there is in that idea and just how much the Jews had to do with it. And who else would maybe be responsible for that? But for now, I'm now anxious to turn to my guest, Dr. Westerle. Welcome, Andreas.
Thank you.
Sorry I took so long, but I did want to set the tone here. Now, you lived through the Morgenthau Plan as a youth,
yes,
actually.
Yes, I did. I survived.
Yes, you did. And you've also studied and written about it as an adult. And
yes,
it was one of the most evil plans ever devised for an entire nation of people. So I'd like to talk about this man, Morgenthau, and just how he managed to bring this about. But first, perhaps we should describe just what the plan consisted of and what parts of it were actually implemented and for how long.
Well, to trace the roots, you'd probably have to go back, God knows, for many, many decades. But the central sentence that should concern us here is, I'm quoting here, this program for eliminating war, so-called war-making industry in the Ruhr and the Tsar is looking forward to converting Germany to a country primarily agricultural and pastoral in character. Germany primarily agricultural and pastoral in character, which of course would not just have negated all of the German industry built up since about, say 1860, but would have deprived more than 80% of all Germans of their livelihood, and then most likely those 80% would have died. that is 80% of 100 million, including Austria, unless those 80% would have been permitted to immigrate to the United States and Canada, which, of course, they were not, because for the first years after the war, officially at least, no Germans were permitted to go into or to immigrate into the United States. But whatever it was, 60, 70, 80 million people would have died during peacetime conditions after May 7th of 1945. That's the day that the armistice was signed.
Generally, they don't use a figure that high. You know, they'll say like, oh, 5 million Germans would have perished under this plan.
That's totally wrong. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you can argue about whether, say, 60 million or 70 million or 70 or 80 million Germans would have died at that time. But if the plan had been carried out in its entirety, it would have involved tens of millions of dead civilians dead during peacetime conditions.
Right. Okay, well, let's clarify that then. The original plan, called the Morgenthau Plan, was one thing, and then it wasn't implemented quite as drastically as this man wanted. And now, Henry Morgenthau, he was the son of a German-Jewish family, but actually they'd been in the United States for a long time. But
right.
Supposedly their ancestry was German, but Jewish. And then his assistant was Harry Dexter White, who was the son of Lithuanian Jewish immigrants.
And he was a communist sympathizer.
Yes, because in 1953, the FBI leveled Soviet spy charges against him.
Very believably, yeah.
Yes, yeah. Well, I don't think there's any argument about that anymore, that he was working for the communists. Do you?
Right.
So, and Morgenthau, who was Morgenthau working for? Do you know of any strong connections that he had with international Jewish organizations?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not an expert on the person of Henry Morgenthau, you know, but it seems logical that he was one of the representatives of Wall Street in the Roosevelt cabinet, since he was the Secretary of Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, having very strong influence with Roosevelt personally, he was able to exert a lot of influence and a lot of power. Also over General Eisenhower, who was getting ready to first to conquer Western Europe and then to administer the various military governments, especially in Western Germany and so on. And so Morgenthau pulled all strings, including his close affinity and his strong influence over Roosevelt, to have the American generals and the British and the French generals, of course, also act according to his beliefs, according to his hatred, you know.
Yes, and then Roosevelt was also, he also had other Jewish advisors, Rabbi Wise, and there's a Goldham, and there was a number of them
right.
that visited him regularly. And Roosevelt
right.
seems to be, he had his own German hatreds, which he expressed at times. In fact, as same as Eisenhower, both of them showed,
right.
Expressed their own hatred toward the Germans. But Roosevelt also, around that time, in mid to late 44, he started deteriorating. In spite, you know, there was his personality there, but also
right.
he didn't seem to have his wits about him, and that's
right.
why he was the easy prey for these advisors, who he, for some reason, gave precedence over other advisors that he had, who were advising differently and telling him
right.
that this was a very bad idea.
Right.
Like Stimson, how do you...
Stimson was the Secretary of War, and he was a Republican, and he was a lot more realistic about various aspects of the so-called post-war reconstruction. And he did not back the Morgenthau Plan by any chance or by any stretch of the imagination. And so Stimson was against it, and then later on Stettinius, who became the new Secretary of State, he was also very skeptical of the Morgenthau plan. So these people, and even before Stettinius, there was Hall, was kind of fuddy-duddy from Tennessee, who was always overruled by Roosevelt. But even Hall was against the more criminal, more vicious aspects of the Morgenthau plan. But Morgenthau, as you said, had a very strong influence over Roosevelt also in personal matters. And he was able to cajole or push Roosevelt in various directions. Especially in September of 1944, it's the second conference of Quebec and Eastern Canada, when this Morgenthau plan was, well, almost made into law, you know, in the presence of Churchill. And Churchill himself, which I should mention, had a good old buddy, his so-called scientific advisor, whom he apparently knew since 1918 or 1919, the glorious days at the University of Oxford at that time, he met a young scientist named Dr. Lindemann.
Let's talk about him. Why was he so anti-German? You know, I've read about him, and he didn't seem to have any sympathy at all for Germany, and he was German.
He was Jewish.
Oh, I didn't know I was trying to find out if Lindemann
was Jewish.
Oh, well, then there you go.
Right.
That explains it.
Right.
They didn't mention that in, they don't say that everywhere about him.
C.P. Snow, that well-known physicist and writer who wrote a few critiques of this entire, the Allied bombing of Germany during the Second World War, after the war, after it was too late. And then C.P. Snow said that the Britishers, the technicians and scientists who were working on these British weapons, four-engined planes and all that, they regarded Dr. Lindemann as kind of an alien. He looked different from the British. He acted different, allegedly. And so C.P. Snow later on became a well-known author, sort of blamed Lindemann for all the crimes that the British committed as far as bombing German cities and towns during the Second World War, you know, which was an exaggeration.
Well, sure.
Lindemann certainly had a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. And then at his second conference.
But then he was Jewish, so that's really interesting.
Yes, he was
Jewish. You have another, and he was very influential over Winston Churchill.
Exactly.
And then Morgenthau was so influential over Roosevelt.
Right.
And there were others in both of their circles that were also Jewish. And
that's right. Like Harry Dexter White and other people.
Yeah, and in Winston Churchill's circles also.
Right, yes.
Eisenhower had also his connections with Jews through Bernard Baruch, who was really his mentor. And through him, he was elevated to his high position. And Eisenhower made amazing statements, like he told Ambassador Halifax in July 1944 that he felt the enemy leader should be shot while trying to escape. That was one way to take care of him before they ever had to have trials, you know. This is long before.
Right.
Here you have almost a year before the war was over, and they were already figuring out how they were going to eliminate all these Germans.
Right.
And he said terrible things.
Eisenhower and his aides also had all these infamous so-called prisoner war camps constructed in Western Germany, west of the Rhine, or along the Rhine.
Oh, yes.
Where the soldiers had to live for months and months and months, totally out in the open with no roof over their heads, just in a few muddy holes in the ground, and most of them died, you know.
Yeah, well, now here now there's a, yes, well, yes, that's true, and that's something I should do a whole program on sometime, but people are pretty much aware of it, but it's really, it's beyond belief how awful it was. But now here, Eisenhower he was the head of Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Forces, SHAEF, and at SHAEF, the financial advisor there was a Colonel Bernard Bernstein, so we know what he was. And so then, Morgenthau goes to visit Eisenhower. He and Morgenthau agreed that extermination could be left to nature if the Russians had a free hand. And
right.
things like that. Now, you know, they search in German documents, in diaries like Goebbels' diaries, whatever, hunting
yeah.
for any sign that they approved of any kind of atrocity, and they make, you know, they turn it into beyond more than it even was. But now
right.
the Allies have all kinds of horrible statements. I mean, we could do a whole program just listing them, truthfully, and things of this nature, and we're supposed to just say, oh, well, of course, you know, that was wartime, or that, you know, we made all kinds of excuses are made. But they
right.
were very, very bloodthirsty.
Let me say another thing here
yeah.
about the Russians. Of course, Stalin was one of the, perhaps, the greatest mass murderer of all time, with the exception of Roosevelt, you know. But when the Red Army penetrated into Germany, that is, into today's Germany, when they attacked East Prussia, all that, they were totally barbarous and ruthless, and they dragged away the population of Königsberg, which is best known for the great philosophers Kant and Hamann and so on, and they dragged all the people into the Volkuta coal mining district north of the Ural Mountains near the Arctic Sea, where in the winter the temperature goes down to 50 and 60 below zero, you know, and most of them died, and so they were absolutely barbarous and East Prussia and all that, and they, of course, also carried out mass raping of women, not just in Germany, but also in Bohemia, Moravia, and Slovakia, Hungary, that I personally know of. So they committed all these terrible things, and they stole everything that they could get their hands on, you know, especially valuable machines, tools.
Yeah.
In spite of that, the Russians did not accede to the Morgenthau plan. They did not plan to decimate the German population.
No, they wanted to take it over, though. Their plan was to turn Germany into a Soviet satellite, and they wanted
exactly.
strong Germany. And the Jews wanted a weak Germany. They wanted it to be totally decimated on its knees.
That's right, totally, or practically a graveyard, you know.
Yes,
but
yes,
the Russians
really.
Did not. The Russians
no.
were interested in having a strong communist bulwark in Central Europe against capitalism, from where they could branch out later on and overrun France and Britain and possibly the United States, you know.
Well, and then we have to say that that's then the only reason that in 1947, or it wasn't until 1947 that
yeah.
Truman decided that they had to change policy, only for that reason, and they had to stop punishing Germany the way they'd been doing and
that's
allowing
right.
them all to die, and they had to bring Germany back in, on their side, so that they could fight this the communists, which were now the enemy and the menace.
Right.
But before we go on this, let's make sure that we've said what the Morgenthau plan consisted of. It had the demilitarization of Germany, the partitioning of Germany. Roosevelt thought they would remove the Ruhr, they would remove the area that give it to Poland on the other side, and then
yeah.
they would divide Germany into three parts. But then it became just two parts, a South German and a North German state. And of course Austria was also cut off again.
Well,
and then they were going to destroy the Ruhr area
yeah.
and not allow it to be industrialized, turn it into an agricultural area. And the,
right.
and then they said over and over again, I read that Roosevelt, this probably I think started with Morgenthau, but then Roosevelt picked it up. That seriously, we're talking about how the Germans could just live off soup from the military government for like ever, you know, just live off soup. They didn't have to make any money. They didn't have to be able to support themselves. I don't mean individual Germans. They'd all be working at something. But I mean the German nation, you know, was
right.
not going to have any industry or any way to support itself. They could just live off soup forever, and they just keep them weak like that. And it was going to be a soup kitchen economy. But then it was really only probably Stalin, the communist menace, that changed that.
Right. It really throws a bright light on the mentality of Roosevelt, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Oh, yeah, because he was saying that. I had some quotes here. He was at the end of these discussions. We're already at Quebec, and Stimson is trying to argue against this. They had a meeting on September 9th, and the full Morgenthau plan was ready, and it was presented, and I think the cabinet was there, or a bunch of them. And Roosevelt is saying that he preferred feeding the Germans from soup kitchens instead of anything heavier. But he was concerned with being protected from the expected revolution in France. And Stimson says these were his two obsessions at the time, and that's all he was interested in. And then he says Roosevelt flipped through the pages of Morgenthau's memorandum and kept prodding Morgenthau. Where is the ban on uniforms and marching? Because he had said that he wanted to have this ban on uniforms and no marching of Germans. They couldn't wear uniforms and stuff. So this is what he's thinking about. And Morgenthau reassures him it's all there. Then he exclaims, furthermore, I believe in an agricultural Germany. And, you know, and then at Quebec, somebody, Simpson, I guess, saying that Roosevelt's brain was withering so much that at one point he didn't know, he couldn't contribute anything. And so he turned his dog and pointed at Morgenthau and said, say hello to your Uncle Henry. And things like that, you know, he was trying to be funny, and because he just couldn't function. And this is the kind of business, this is how our governments do business so often. And he's not unusual. We have presidents like this. Reagan was gone mentally, and then Roosevelt, they're no better than George Bush was. You know, they talk about what a moron George Bush was. He probably behaved just the same way in these meetings.
Right.
So I'm sorry.
Roosevelt had himself elected to a lifetime of the presidency. He had himself elected four times, you know.
That's right. He was.
So he actually was a dictator.
Yeah, he was.
Lifetime dictator, yeah. Oh, but anyway, before we forget, this Morgenthau program, or whatever you want to call it, was encapsulated in the Joint Chiefs of Staff Directive 1067, which was worked out at that time, first of all, in its most draconian phase in September of 1944, which is approved by Roosevelt, and then again in April of 1945, and then it was published, and on October 17th, 1945, and I've got it right here, and it says, which is a very kind of a tragic comic corrective of what today's German regime is always saying. They were saying that, they keep saying all the time that all these wonderful people were just liberating us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Chancellor Merkel was in Moscow in May of saluting the Red Army and of liberating the German people, which is totally a criminal to say something like that or to act like that. But here in this Joint Chiefs of Staff directive, it says Germany will not be occupied for the purpose of liberation, but as a defeated enemy nation.
Yes. Yes, and well, that's all they say over and over again, that they need to punish Germany, that they wanted to starve them. They didn't want to give them hardly anything to eat, so that they would feel, they would never forget what they had done and things like that, you know.
Right, and discourage fraternization, whatever that meant. And of course, it didn't work. Then also a crucial phase in the Joint Chiefs of Staff directive. It says, the controls may be essential to protect the safety and meet the needs of the occupying forces and assure the production and maintenance of goods and services required to prevent starvation or such disease and unrest as would endanger those forces. In other words, the occupiers could act towards the Germans, let alone help them or assist them or anything, but act towards the Germans only as far as their own safety was concerned. And outside of that, you know, millions of Germans could die, civilians could die.
Yeah, well, I think we could say that this was extreme hatred, and we have to look to see who is most capable of having extreme hatred for others and carry out policies of extreme hatred. Well, Andres, we have to stop for our break now, and when we come back, we will turn to the Allied war crimes trials see what we can say about that.
Okay.
Stick with us, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
And thousands of mourners have gathered in Bahrain for the funerals of anti-government protesters killed in a brutal crackdown. The riot police and the Gulf State reportedly used supplies made by British companies to clear the protest. Human rights watchdogs are calling for an embargo on arms supplies and a disclosure of why export licenses were issued. Well, for more, I'm joined by Barnaby Pace. He's from the Campaign Against the Arms Trade. He's in London. Thanks indeed for joining us. Now, up until now, Bahrain has been a stable and a good partner for Britain because of its strategic importance in the Gulf. So shouldn't the UK supply them with riot control equipment?
Well, I think there's something of a catch-22. If you're selling someone weapons and they want to buy weapons, it's generally speaking because they intend to use those weapons at some point. And so stepping back and saying, oh, well, we sold them the tear gas and we're terribly shocked that they used that tear gas on protesters is somewhat disingenuous.
But even Britain has protesters in the streets and you get violent protests. Surely authorities need some way of controlling crowds.
Well, possibly so, but you can see that this was always going to be possible. We may say that Bahrain was a healthy ally, but we can see across the Middle East that the UK government is selling to repressive regimes all over that this could happen at any a point in. And we've got to be aware that when we're selling both non-lethal and lethal equipment, those will be used, and generally at some point that they'll be used on someone innocent.
But bearing in mind that obviously the arms trade is a very big industry, not just in Britain but many countries throughout the world, how can possibly a country that sells arms to another country have influence in the way they're used?
Well, this is the problem, is that once you've handed over the weapons, you have little control over how they're used. But that doesn't mean you can morally justify handing them over in the first place. If you're selling someone weapons, the weapons are going to be used. Your chain of moral responsibility doesn't stop once you've handed over the weapons. And frankly, the UK government needs to seriously reconsider how it approaches arms sales in the first place. Not only have these arms been licensed to be sold overseas in the case of Bahrain, but they are actively promoted as such. The UK government actively promotes arms sales to a number of repressive regimes. This very weekend, the UK government is sending representatives out to the large arms fair in Abu Dhabi, it's called IDEX, of which the arms industry trade body in the UK claims 10% of its exhibitors will be British at this fair, and the UK actively encourages these companies to sell, including the very equipment that is being used in protesters in the Middle East as we speak.
But are you saying that Britain...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, here with Dr. Andreas Wesserle, who is a recognized scholar of the topics under review. My overriding question today, as we move on to the Allied war crimes trials, is how large a role did Jewish interests and personalities play, including the decision to have them have the trials at all and on what legal basis they were created. So, Dr. Westerle, what can you say about that and anything else you want to say about these trials?
Could I say one more marginal remark about the Morgenthau Plan?
Of course.
After the death of Roosevelt and Truman had something pithy to say about Morgenthau, he eased Morgenthau out of office in July of 1945, saying that Morgenthau doesn't know shit from apple butter.
Oh, Truman said that?
That's what Truman said, you know, typical Trumanian remark. He does no shit from apple butter.
And he meant about, like, treasury matters?
Well, he probably meant all kinds of policies, including the plan against Germany, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, because, you know, Truman is kind of a mixed-up guy there. He didn't go for a lot of this stuff, but at the same time, he had a confused feeling about Jews, it seems.
Well, yeah.
One way, he didn't tolerate them, and another way, he wanted to please certain of them also, and certain Israeli policies. So.
Well, yeah, we can say that he was put under pressure by certain aspects of Wall Street, who made it clear to Truman that if he didn't approve the creation of Israel and the overweening power that Israel has in the world, if he didn't approve that, then Wall Street would withdraw its money from the United States and go someplace else, and then the U.S. would collapse, you know. So he had, most probably had to face that kind of blackmail by a certain aspect of Wall Street.
What interests do you think were prominent in these Nuremberg trials?
Well,
whose interests were being served?
Mostly revenge. There were two main points, revenge and number two, I mean revenge of their own feelings of hatred, not objective kind of revenge. You know, okay, like they killed 100,000 so-and-so, now we're going to kill 500,000 Germans. It was much worse than that. So a revenge, a kind of subjective hatred, was one of the points. And the second point, probably even more important, was that the largest powers just carved out empires as spheres of influence. The United States on one hand, and Stalin and the Soviet Empire on the other, you know. Stalin, for instance, talked about dismembering Germany and not having any other war offensives from Germany east in the eastward direction into Russia, which of course wasn't true, but that was in 1944, 1945. By 1952, Stalin and his advisors proposed to Adenauer a neutralized but strong Germany, which will receive its eastern territories back, the eastern states of Silesia and Pomerania and Prussia and so on. Stalin was ready to give that back to Germany if Germany would be neutral and not join NATO.
Mm-hmm.
That's the price that Stalin was willing to pay. That's an extreme about-face from his position in 1944 and 1945, yeah.
Well, these trials were being talked about in 44. Even in 1943, they were talking about, what are we going to do? How are we going to handle these Nazis? You know, what are we going to
right.
do? And so they divided it up because that was the most reasonable way to go about it. But they
right.
did want to crush what they called Nazism totally. And well, what other explanations are there?
Well, Roosevelt wanted to eliminate the so-called German philosophy, whatever he meant by that, which was long before National Socialism, you know, say, a Prussian ascendancy or Prussian goals of establishing a strong and self-reliant and industrialized Germany with great universities and a great system of education. So Roosevelt wanted to destroy all of that, And he did, you know, he succeeded in doing that.
Do you think Roosevelt was a communist?
No, I don't think so.
What was he anyway?
He made some strange remarks to, what's his name, the Irish cardinal from New York, the little chubby guy. And he said to him, this cardinal came to the White House and so on, because both of them actually had the same personal inclinations, which I don't want to mention. But Roosevelt said to the cardinal, well, I hope the Russians are going to be more civilized in 50 to 60 years, and then by that time they might become more human and so on. But at the moment I can't do a thing about the inhuman behavior of the Russians and all that. He totally bypassed the fact that he himself, Roosevelt, supported the Russians materially in such a way as to make possible the Russian victories in the East. You know, if Roosevelt hadn't done that, the Russians would most probably not have been able to prevail in the Eastern warfare.
Well, this man doesn't make any sense. More and more, he's like, there's something really wrong with this man and his thinking. So many of these leaders are so irresponsible when you really find out about it. They're just like careless in the extreme, and just no matter what happens to people, they're not suffering it, and they don't seem to care. Now, these war crimes trials, it seems like they had to finally come to what they did with them in order to protect themselves. You know, they had to make a big deal out of making the Germans totally responsible for everything that happened. And then the Jews wanted to make them guilty of war crimes and so on, and build up the Holocaust. And so there we had what we had. How much do you think was the Jewish power behind the Allied war crimes trials?
Well, that's very hard to determine, you know. That was definitely substantial. And also before the outbreak of the European war on September 3rd, 1939, there were very strong Jewish pressure groups in Britain who backed Churchill because they saw that he was a more aggressive and ruthless individual, and he would be more amenable to their goals and their systematic approach to the future, you know.
Could we say that there were a lot of forces that weren't just Jewish behind the whole war and the trials afterwards, and the plan and everything we're talking about, but it was the Jewish element that made it more vicious and hateful and extreme?
Right. That certainly could be said, right.
So what about this Kellogg-Briand Pact? From 1928. Were they following that, or how does that fit in with what
was
being
done? Well, that was a very strange kind of a thing that could only be understood in the context of the 1920s, which were sort of a repulsion from the bloody experience of the First World War, you know, and a kind of an emphasis on dollar diplomacy and emphasis on peaceful means of diplomacy, to some extent, anyway. And Briand, who was the foreign minister of France, of course, from 1919 to 1939, was outside of Soviet Russia, of course, and outside of Poland, those two others in the east, outside of Soviet Russia and outside of Poland. France was the most aggressive and the most expansionistic nation in Europe in those 20 years, because they were scared of another war, of course, and they didn't know exactly what to do about it, but they're irrationally revanchelisten, as it said in German, you know. They were intent upon revenge and intent upon grabbing onto the position of power that France had captured at the so-called Peace Conference of Paris in 1919. So Briand came out of that, and of course Kellogg was the American Secretary of State. And it was actually just a declaration to abjured to say no to military offensive, to military aggression in the future.
Unlawful. It said wars entered into in self-defense would be lawful, but otherwise they were not lawful. So how did the Allies justify what they did in World War II? I mean,
this Briand-Killick Pact was not a recognized part and parcel of international law. See, you could not build.
It says on Wikipedia that it remains even now binding under international law.
And in
the United States, it remains in force as federal law.
Well, that's just propaganda. I mean, when the Kellogg-Briand Pact was signed by many, many dozens of states in those days, mm-hmm. most of those states, particularly the Soviet Union and the United States, were engaged in military aggression against other nations, you know, like U.S. and Central America.
In what way is what the Allies did in the war crimes trials illegal, based on what we do know?
It's null and void. Their contention, the Allied contention, that after 1919, that there was a structure of international law which made...
Oh, aggressive war illegal.
So-called aggressive war mm-hmm. illegal. It did not exist.
Oh, okay. So therefore, well, of course we know they were making laws after the fact to apply to what had taken place.
It was an ex post facto law according to the American mm-hmm. Constitution.
Right. And how do they actually get around that today? Just by being in power and nobody can do anything about it? Or do they have some kind of...
Well, they tried to prove that at least the National Socialist regime in Germany after 1933 had... from the very start, planned aggressive action, aggressive war against God knows whom, Poland or France, etc., etc., which was, of course, not true. They also failed to mention that the League of Nations clause that was inserted into the so-called Versailles Peace in the final document of the so-called Peace Treaty of Paris in 1919, saying that all countries, both the defeated and the victor nations, had to demilitarize, that to reduce the extent of their armies and navies and air forces and all that. And none of them did that. The only ones that were forced to do it were Germany, Austria, and Hungary, you know, and mm-hmm. Bulgaria and so on.
Mm-hmm.
The former,
well, that's true. What about the trials in Tokyo? How do you compare those, or how do they compare with what took place in Nuremberg?
Basically, it was very similar, with the exception of the fact that, of course, Japan had been trying to gain spheres of influence, particularly in Korea and North of Korea and in Manchuria, as against the Tsarist Empire in 1905, and then again in 1919 at the Peace Conference of Versailles, of Paris, so-called. And after that, the Japan tried to build upon these spheres of influence in southern Manchuria by going into northern Manchuria. And from there on, after the depression became extremely problematic and extremely severe, even in Japan, after 1930 and 1931, by invading China proper in the direction of Beijing and Nanking and all those places. So, as far as the Japanese were concerned, they could possibly be accused of having a expansionistic foreign policy in the footsteps of the British Empire, the French Empire, and the United States Empire in the Pacific, you know. It was just a clash of empires. And the Japanese one was the smaller one among the four of them, you know.
Were the Japanese, the Tokyo war crimes trials carried out by the Americans only?
Mainly, yeah. General MacArthur was very smooth and very intelligent in excluding Soviet influence from Japan, you know. He didn't want any Russians in Japan, even though Roosevelt at the Yalta Conference in February 1945 gave huge concessions to his good buddy and intimate friend, Uncle Joe Stalin, you know. He gave him control of southern Manchuria, which is an extremely strategic position vis-a-vis China on one hand, vis-a-vis Japan on the other. And Manchuria have been built up into a thriving industrial region by the Japanese. This will now all be cashed in by the Soviets, you know, Stalin and his minions.
What did the United States...
That was done by Roosevelt in Yalta in 1945, against the advice of Harriman, who at that time was American, whatchamacallit, in Moscow.
Yeah.
Harriman, April Harriman.
Supposedly, the Harrimans and the Bushes were Nazis.
What's
that? Those conspiracy theories that I've been trying to defeat, the Harrimans and the Bushes who worked for them and their banking, is, you know, they were dealing with the Nazis and making money off of Auschwitz and so on, which is actually not actually true. But then, you know, at the same time, he's Roosevelt's emissary to Moscow, so... You know, it's so much craziness in these, all these
Harriman
stories.
Harriman was a bit more realistic, more intelligent than Roosevelt was, you know.
Well, yeah, he had more business intelligence. I don't know what Roosevelt had. But now, let's ask the question. Did the United States have any right to put these Japanese leaders and military people on trial the way he did?
No, they didn't.
Yeah.
Unless they would have, as is also true in Nuremberg, even to a greater extent, unless they put some of their own military leaders on trial for war crimes against the Japanese, you know, and against the Filipinos in 1898 and 1900 and 1902, there was an extremely bloody campaign of repression against the Filipino independence movement at that time. And none of that is mentioned. You know, another thing that's not mentioned is that under, what's his name, General, that cigar-chomping, short, fat guy of the Air Corps.
What,
anyway, he devastated the Japanese cities in 1945 with the B-29s. Curtis LeMay, that was his name. Curtis
LeMay. He short? I didn't know he was short.
Well, he looked short and fat. Anyway, and the big cigar. And he and his associates, of course, caused a loss of 1.2 million civilians in Japan. In other words, 1.2 million Japanese civilians died of the attacks, air attacks, so-called conventional air attacks in 1945. Plus, of course, 300,000 more in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yeah.
Yes.
So 1.5 million Japanese civilians had to bite the dust just to satisfy the, the goals of the American military leaders, you know.
Yes.
And only 800,000 in comparison to that, only 800,000 Japanese soldiers fell in the Second World War. So 800,000 soldiers on one hand and 1.5 million civilians on the other. You know?
Well, it definitely was a massacre of civilians, the Second World War.
Yeah, it certainly was.
Along with soldiers. But
mostly carried out by the Allies.
Yes. Yes, so now here we have the Allies who carried out these military trials and hung the leaders of the nations that they fought against. And that's kind of unusual. That's not usually, that isn't whatever happened before in any kind of modern times.
Right.
And so now we have this idea that war is outlawed, but they were still having wars. But they don't call them war. They call them military engagements, except in a euphemistic way, war on terror and stuff. But none of these wars that we've been having, I guess, are actually declared wars. So they're not responsible. We're not responsible for aggressive war, even though we're carrying it out.
Right. Even all those terrible crimes against civilians that we carried out, war crimes and crimes against humanity that we carried out in Iraq since 1991, mm-hmm. and Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the push of American empire into Central Asia and into the Caspian Sea, and all that, all these other phenomena, it's just not mentioned. It's just, oh, well, it's just another thing, you know. Let's proceed to some other details, you know. And the daily propaganda machine is represented by all channels on TV and the newspapers, magazines,
okay,
Hollywood,
well, now who
everything.
Did, who is, who, there you go. Who are the main culprits behind what is covering up what needs to be revealed or what we just need, it's been revealed, what we just need to be able to talk about? You know, what, who is keeping the lid on all of that?
Well, we all know who's doing that. It's a certain nation that calls itself the only chosen nation, the only nation chosen by God, you know. They're the ones who are mostly responsible for all that, for all
those
lies.
Here we go. So just like Morgenthau was able to manipulate Roosevelt, who was far more powerful than Morgenthau, Lindemann could manipulate Winston Churchill, who didn't need much manipulation, but you know, he again, you know, these people, they're not as powerful, but they're able to wield the power. Now, what is that secret? Are they so clever? And this is what's going on in the world today. And people, our people, all over the world, not only European people, but all kinds of other people, are being kept from looking, noticing, talking mostly about it, saying anything, pointing the finger where it belongs, because these people have manipulated everybody. This is huge, you know, and this is outrageous, and this is what we're fighting against.
It's exactly true. It's a global manifestation, global phenomenon, you know.
It's so unbelievable that people can't believe it. This is this big lie thing. And, you know, it's like people wouldn't believe that, oh, that Henry Morgenthau couldn't have talked Roosevelt into all of this. And or just even Woodrow Wilson had his own people behind the scenes telling him what to do. These people are so good at that. What they have some kind of a ability or secret. Or then although like you have brought up, they have Wall Street, or they have international banking, they have international finance behind them, which is often what they use to blackmail leaders of nations. And so you have these weak leaders who they've been made by the media to look like strong, to look like demigods. Look at just to go off the topic here, but look at Barack Obama. Really has no qualifications whatsoever, and he was just built up, made to look like somebody who could save the world.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he's surrounded by all of these chosen people on all sides, you know.
That's right. Well, we're going to have to stop for now. I think we got the point across, or I did. I'm trying to get the point across. And we will talk again about some of these things and other things. And I appreciate very much that you come back on the program. I look forward to you coming back another time. And we will continue with this topic, ladies and gentlemen, in one way or another. Thank you for listening tonight. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.